A Motorsport Podcast Network production. Hey everybody, Aaron Noonan here. Welcome to the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. We've had our halftime oranges. We are good to go. It's part two with the great man, Jim Richards. He's got some ripping stories in this part of the podcast, including how he ended up with a Bob Jane T-Marts franchise, about racing Formula 5000s, the time he tried to do the Le Mans 24 Hour with Peter Brock and Colin Bond. Spoiler alert, didn't go well, but that's part of the story. His long-time racing Porsches in Australia and Touring Car Masters, the Falcon Sprint and the AMC Javelin, cars that are close to the heart of many muscle car fans around the country. Jimmy also tackles your National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions, and we talk memorabilia thanks to our friends at the Motorsport Trader. So here we go, buckle up, really tight. It's time to start part two of Jim Richards on the V8 Sleuth Podcast, powered by Repco. So were you clearly you're full time in Oz, family's here. Yeah. Didn't you end up running a Bob Jane T-Marts and owning one of those? Was it with your brother or your cousin?
No, my cousin.
Your cousin, that's right.
Yeah, my cousin Ralph.
So the Bob Jane connection sort of
The Bob Jane connection happened during the racing. Because a lot of the time that in the sports sedan races, they would invite three drivers and then fill the field with the local sports sedan guys. So Janey always sort of went with Pat Purcell and the guys in the Monaro. I'd always go in the Mustang or whatever. And so we got to be friends at the track because we raced against each other. And Bob probably beat me more than I beat him. But it was a friendly, nice relationship where, you know, he'd come over and say, come on, have a beer with us. And he'd go over and have a beer with him, you know. But the T-Mart thing, when my cousin Ralph Jones came over, he was looking for something different. So we thought we'd start a little mechanical workshop because we were both mechanics. And the motor racing wasn't paying at all. You know, we were always in debt, you know.
Even though you sell the caravans and cars.
Yeah, but we paid all the bills. It wasn't that bad, but and he was a qualified mechanic as well. So we thought we'd start a little business, and we had backing from Shell Oil, you know, to free petrol type of deal. And we thought we might approach them maybe we can get a couple of petrol pumps and a nice little workshop, and we'll get some tyres through Bob Jane to sell, just to start, you know, making a normal living. Well, the first time I mentioned to Bob, could they sell us some tyres? Are you allowed to swear badly on this?
You can do what you like and we'll deal with it later.
Okay. Because Bob was a very outspoken, don't take your lady or your girlfriend around when he was talking to the boys, for God's sake.
There was some potty mouth action going on. Yeah.
And so I went up at a race meeting and said, Bob, my cousin introduced Ralph. My cousin and I are thinking of starting a little mechanical repair business and get maybe some tyres off. Could you sell us some tyres? He says, what? I said, yeah, well, we were both mechanics. He said, you guys don't need a mechanical shop. That's bullshit. He said, you need a fucking T-Mart. And we said, well, we've never sold our own cars, let alone selling tyres and in a place. No, he said, it's easy. He said, you need a T-Mart. That's what you need to go into. He says, yeah, Ralph, can you start work the next few days? And Ralph said, yeah.
Where's this going?
he said, well, I've got a spot opening up at the City T-Mart. Go down there, start work, just selling tyres, get in there, sussing out the way that the place is run, because I still was racing at the top the time, and just get a guess on what's going on, and I'll have to think about it. But I'll get a contract ready for you. And so Ralph says, yeah, okay. So Ralph,
this all happens,
he went
suddenly
to the City T-Mart and got to learn how to sell tyres. And I just went about my business and type of thing. And then when it came time to see Janey for the contract, to the going to the T-Mart, da-da-da-da-da.
So this is to become a franchise.
This is a franchisee, yeah. We didn't know much about it. We just, you know, taking Bob's word for it. So he came down and he had a contract. He said, there you go. There's the contract. You've signed that, mate. You're going to the T-Mart and you'll be laughing. And I said, yeah, but what about money? He said, well, I want $100,000 for the franchise. I said, just looked at Ralph and Ralph looked at me and said,
we just wanted to buy a couple of tyres to put in our servo.
He said, we can't do that. We haven't got enough money. I need a long way. He said, how much you got? And I looked at Ralph, and then Bob said, come on, between the two of you, what sort of money can you get? And I said, well, I can probably borrow some off my mum or something, and $5,000. And Ralph said, I can give it $5,000. It was $10,000. He said, okay. He said, that's all right. He said, you give me your $10,000. He said, you go and work. I've got a team art picked out for you in Preston. Go and take over the team art. He said, and here's a deposit book to my bank. He said, every day at the end of the day, tally up your money. First thing in the morning, go down to the bank and bank into my account.
Pay it back. So you got $90,000 to catch up on.
So, yeah. So he said, in the meantime, on Thursdays you pay your wages, pay your bills, whatever they are, wherever they are. But you buy your tyres, everything through me. And any excess money you got, bank in my account. So this is all pretty easy at this stage. Mm. So anyway, we go into the team art and we look at the contract, and the contract basically said that you will come and work on a team art, and if you're no bloody good, we'll take it off you. Sort of, you know.
We're protecting our brand, I think they call it these days.
But anyway, no, you said we took it to an accountant that we ran into, and showed the accountant. He said, no, you can't, don't sign that. No, you've got nothing. You end up with nothing. So I said, oh, shit, okay. So anyway, we went back to Bob in Bob's office. He says, how'd you go? I said, and I had the contract in my hand, and I put it on his desk, and he said, how'd you go? What are you up to? I said, well, we went to an accountant, and he said we shouldn't sign it. Bob said, he's looked at us and he said, look, and he grabbed the contract, and he leant down and opened a big drawer on his desk right at the bottom of the drawer. You know, and we're sort of looking over, what the hell's he doing? And he gets the contract, and he sticks it in the drawer, slams the drawer shut. He said, sign the contract. The contract goes in that drawer and it doesn't come out. What's that mean? Well, means that go and make some money. Pay me back and we'll worry about the rest of it later. So I looked at Ralph and Ralph looked at me and we went, okay. So Bob, as the faults that you had and the failings that you had, everyone's got their own. But had it not been for him, there is no way we'd be doing what we're doing now.
Mm.
And so us operating his team art, he owned the land, he owned the building.
And this is the one in Preston.
Yeah, one in Preston.
Yeah.
So we were paying him back from his business.
Yeah.
To end up buying it. You know what I mean?
Just negatively geared it around the other way.
Like, yeah. We were paying it as we had a good wage. And he said to us, Because they're not a road, don't get me wrong. One of the team things was, as soon as you got a team out, you went and bought a new Benz. You know what I mean? You put it on lease. And one of the last things he said to us, he said, now listen, when you pay yourself a decent wage, no problem. He said, a car each, no dramas, but don't go fucking crazy.
So a Merck's out of the question here, I think. Something simple, keep it simple.
So he was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. You know, I mean, never. I haven't got a bad word to say about him. It was bloody good. So in a year, we had the team art paid for.
Really?
Right?
That's a lot of tyres.
It's a lot of – anyway. And then – because you didn't tell us the start. As soon as we finished the paying the franchise off, because all the stock we were selling was Bob's.
Yeah.
And he would deliver it to our show and we'd sell it. He said, okay, that's great. You're now team art owners, business owners. He says, now I want you to pay me for the fucking tyres. Another $120,000.
He was
fantastic, fantastic.
So would you recommend franchiseeing to anybody out there?
Well, when we were doing it, and it's a lot harder now, and there's no way that the Bob would let you go if he was alive. I think that was the last time he did it, but it worked out good because, we got on well. We had respect for each other, and we knew he was doing us a big favour.
So when you said before about had that bit not happened, all the rest of it wouldn't have happened. So you reckon had that business opportunity not arisen, you'd have gone back to New Zealand because you were out of money for the racing?
We would have started a little business with fixing cars.
You would have done your own thing, and then who knows where it could have gone in the line after that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. there's so many oddities along the way that you've had a crack at everything. Formula 5000.
Yeah.
How did that come to be? You sort of, we don't think open wheelers and Jim Richards together, but there was a little time that you had to go. How did that
come to be? There was, at the time, there was the Rothman series had.
Late 70s, we're talking.
80, I think. 81, somewhere around that. And it was a 5000 series that they got cars from the States and from England that would come out and run, and a couple of old Formula One cars, the Wolfs, ran at the time that I ran. And Janie wanted to have a, because it was a big deal, to have a representation.
He was in everything. There was a Bob Jane car in just about any series.
And Alan Coleman said, could you get a 5000 and run? I said, well, I don't know. I'll check it up. So because I'd driven for Gossi in the Falcon in a couple of minutes, I'd seen this old Matic that was up in the roof of his workshop in a loft. And I got talking to a guy called Peter Fowler, who built Brian Thompson's Chevy VW.
Yep.
I know this might be strange to some listeners.
That's all good.
And so I said, I've got a chance that I can get a Formula 5000, a Matic, and needs prepping and running for four races in the Rothman series. He says, yep, I can do that. And I said, how much will it cost? He says, don't worry about that yet. I'll get some sponsorship from the local Shepparton people. The Team Shepparton type of deal.
Which they did a bit with Tomo's stuff over the years. Yeah.
And Bob had given us $10,000 sponsorship, but I had to buy the car as well. Same old
story. There's a deal.
So anyway, so we got it and ran it and turned it into a Bob Jones 10-mark car, went up to the loft, Gossi's factory in Sydney, got a forklift and forklifted down from the roof, went to Shepparton, Peter Fowler prepared it, painted in Bob Jane colours and ran it. And we tested it for the first time at Calder. And it was called a short track, not the long track.
Yeah, it was before they lengthened it and stuff, yeah.
And so we hopped in and buzzed around and came in. And Pete said, how's it going? And Peter Fowler said, I said, no, it's good. It gets a little bit hot. It was a hot day anyway. But he said, just go and have another few laps. And just give it a bit of a try, see how you go. So I said, I was sort of trying, but we'll have a go. So I went around, did another five laps, and then came in, and he says, no, it's going good. He said, the time you did would have put you third on the grid for a 5000 championship race. Bearing in mind there was no overseas cars, it was all local, like all the guys. So he said, it's going good enough. Let's not wear it out. Let's take it to the first meeting. And away we went. I think the first meeting was Sandown, I think.
Did you enjoy it? Was it something that you thought,
it was unusual because the wheels, these two wheels in front of you pattering up and down.
Because you can see what your tyres are doing.
Yeah, see where the tyres are and everything. But it wasn't immediately thinking, oh, God, bugger me, because I was used to 600 horsepower.
Well, sports sedans of the era were basically lots of Formula 5000.
Well, it would damage pick up the straight, probably.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it, but we had untold dramas with it.
Mm.
We had a bad oil leak coming from the rear main. It was a 308 Holden engine, and it had overheating because Bob Gossi had originally had moved the radiators that were normally at the front of the car, moving to the side.
Uh-huh.
And whether the angle wasn't quite right or whatever, but it did overheat, not massively, but enough to think, is it going to be okay?
Mm. Is this going to cost us more?
I think the best result, we came either fourth or fifth at Sandown in the first meeting and then got progressively worse.
And that's you in open wheelers?
Yeah, but it was always going to, it was never going
to
be.
It was just a bit of a one-off to fill a gap an opportunity arose.
Yeah, and then we bought the car home and put it in the workshop and I sat there for probably, a year, and then a guy came down and said, I wouldn't mind buying that Matic off you. I said, yeah, no problem. He said, I've got an Alfen 360 sports car with the Repco engine in it.
Yep.
He says, I want to trade that. And I said, I don't really want anything. He says, I'll give you $2,000 in the Alfen for 5000. So I thought to myself, I might be able to sell the sports car easier than the Matic. So I said, yeah, okay, no problem. And he was only about 200 or 300 metres from the old factory that I had. So that did a deal. And now Steve Webb,
John Webb's dad,
I sold it to him for $10,000.
The Elfin?
Yeah.
Back in
1981 or two. And he's still got it. It's probably worth more than half a
worth
million now.
More than what you sold it for, that's for sure. There's a million of those stories, isn't there? Exactly. If only you'd kept things and what they're worth now.
That's right.
And what happened, we're backtracking a bit, but the Mustang, when it, you stopped racing with it, what did you, did it sit around for a while? Did you sell that? What happened there?
Well, the Mustang went back to New Zealand when the Falcon came along.
Mm.
Now, Jerry Clayton, the used car dealer from New Zealand, he owned the Falcon because he'd paid to get it built.
Yep.
Right? So,
who owned the Mustang at that point?
Jerry Clayton.
He owned it.
He sold it to a guy in New Zealand and then he financed the building of the Falcon. I think that he did think probably that he was going to have a lot more success and make a lot of money out of it. But as we know, motor racing did not make a lot of money. But anyway, the sports sedan, after its initial couple of years, was getting a bit tired, needed money spending on it. Da, 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 da. And so the backers in New Zealand, Jerry Clayton, his partner, said, oh, listen, we've got to sell the car. But he said, we've decided we're going to sell it, but we don't want you to race it anymore because, you know, if it blew up, crashed, da, 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 da. Mm. So he said, we're going to take it off you and Peter Jansen's going to store it in his shed because they probably thought that I was going to race it.
If it was still there. Yeah.
So they did that and took the car down. And I was talking to Bob about a week or so later, Bob Jane. And I know Bob Jane and I have had a great relationship and did have. And he said to me, we haven't seen you at the meetings lately. I said, no, I've got the guys that own the car. They've taken it to, they don't want to run it anymore. So they just got it for sale. He said, what, you're not going to run anymore? And I said, well, no, not in that car because I can't afford to buy it. And he said, how much do they want for it? I said, I think they want about $20,000. Come to the office tomorrow morning. I went to his office and he gave me a check for 20 grand.
Go buy it.
And buy it.
So for him to own or you to own?
No, him to buy.
Him to own, yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, yeah. So he owned it and I drove it again for another season. And then sold it again and got most of his money back.
Good deal. That worked. So, and the irony, I recollect that crash in Adelaide when Brock had the Monza off the start. You were in the JPS Bimmer.
Yep.
Didn't your old Falcon end up
on
top of you, didn't it? Oh, gee, you can't get away from your old cars, can you? But I think they're all still around. Isn't the Mustang in New Zealand?
Yeah, Mustang's in New Zealand. He restored it. Made a really good job of it, but then painted his name on the side of it.
Oh, no.
Instead of Citroen.
Oh, right, okay.
And so he said, I wanted Citroen to help me, but they wouldn't. Well, of course.
Modern companies are not going to hand out money for, you know, race
some
cars.
Some guy to restore a car and put it in his shed.
Yeah, it's a nice theory.
Anyway, so and the Falcon is, last I knew, belongs to a guy in Sydney at Campbelltown.
Right, because it was, I think Tony Hubbard was the one who parked it on your head.
Yes, yes.
And Robin Doherty raced it later on without the rear spoiler, more of the lip spoiler. Yeah. Sort
It was a lot better with the lip spoiler.
It looked a bit better. It looked a bit, didn't look right with the other wing on the back of it.
But it was the way things were in those days. You know, put a wing on, gain 2 seconds. Put a wing on and lose 2 seconds, more like it.
Looked cool, but did it do much? Debatable. One of the long-standing relationships you've had to Porsche.
Yep.
We could fill 5 podcast chats and 28 books with you and Porsche because you've done so much with them. But for all the Carrera Cups and the Nations Cups and the Targas and all that stuff, the bit that everyone probably forgets, and I'd love to hear your take. I talked to Bondi a couple of years ago about this.
Yeah.
Jim Richards and Lamont don't normally go together, but there was one year where he and Brock went to go and run a Porsche. I think it was a 924 from memory in 81.
924 GTS, I think it was.
Yeah. How did that all come to be? Because it all turned to crap, didn't it?
Yep,
really, it didn't make it to the race.
I suppose, what year was that?
It was 81.
81.
Good year, that one.
Yeah,
that's 81, when I turned up.
You were born, were you?
Yeah.
At the time, Alan Hamilton had the Porsche agency or the business here in Aussie, and he wanted to go to Le Mans. So he asked Bondi, Brocky, and I, probably because we were in the '80s, we were sort of front runners, not bad driver. You know, good
well, you
driver.
And Brock had just won Bathurst yeah, three exactly, times in a row, exactly, so you're sort exactly. of you're up and about. Yeah.
So he said, "I want to go to Le Mans and run this little car Porsche preparing for us. Why don't you bring your wives with you?
Let's make a trip of it.
Let's make a trip of it." Yeah. And we had guys, photographers, and all sorts coming over with us. And he flew us there, looked after us. We had a Volkswagen Combi to, as a transport car, like a new one. It was bloody beautiful.
Oh, yeah. No, I would just picture you guys in an old 60s Combi humming Brock, around the French countryside.
Brock had a Commodore. It was not
like an Opel or something Opel. Like that. Yeah, yeah.
He had an Opel, and Bondi and I and Faye and I, and we were in the Combi van with all the luggage. And we're going down the Autobahn, and we as fast as we could go on the Combi, 160k an hour.
Pegged.
And Brock was behind us trying to push us. Anyway, but to go there, we went to Porsche factory, and in the little race department, they had 935s. They were getting ready, 956s or whatever the designation was.
Yeah, I think they were 935s or 936s. Yeah, something, yeah.
And they had a couple of 924 development cars, which had different engine. The one that we drove, excuse me, it had an Audi engine, basically. That was the first 924 set Audi engines. And our car was painted, but it was just in a million pieces. And we only had about four days to go to the race.
Was it you blokes have got to put it together if you want to drive it?
No.
I was going to say.
They did it all. Alan was a bit disappointed in that. But anyway, cut a long story short, we got to the track and they were still building the car. Mm-hmm. And Brocky went out first. To do some laps.
Because he'd been there before.
Yeah.
4 or 5 years before that, yeah. in one of the BMs that he
had. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And Brocky went out and drove around, and had gearbox drama. They just wouldn't go into third gear. And the only way you got to go into third gear was if you went into fourth gear first. So instead
of fourth back to third.
Yeah, instead of going from second to third, you went second to fourth to third. But it was quite a long gear change. But anyway, Brocky was just starting to get the hang of it, and kaboom, the motor blew to pieces.
Oh.
So Bondi and I hadn't even had a drive at the stage, right? There was two practices to go, I think. So I brought the car in. We said, "There's a gearbox. Gearbox is terrible." I said, "Well, it won't go into third gear on the upshifts. It'll go into third gear on the downshifts. It won't go in the upshifts." Anyway, they had to put a new engine on it. And so that was a good idea. And we keep saying, yeah, but the gearbox is like, the engine's going to be fantastic, but the gearbox is a big problem as well. Oh, no, it'll be okay. So they got the new engine in it. Brocky went out and did another couple of laps and said, the engine's good, but the gearbox is still the same. So he came in and Bondi says, we've got to get out, even if we do two or three laps.
You've got to qualify to get in the race, you know? Yeah.
So Bondi went out and he got the gear chain sussed where he could really just quickly go second, fourth, third. And the thing was hunting along and Bondi was out there trying to get a time, which we couldn't do because there was cars freaking everywhere, you know, 1,000 mile an hour down the back straight, and we were sort of in the car buzzing along. But anyway, in the end, Bondi said, "You've got to have a drive, Jim." And I said, yeah. He said, because if you don't drive, we can't qualify.
All three have got
to
qualify, yeah.
And Bondi needed to do an extra lap to get the qualifying thing up. And so he came in and I jumped in and away I went and told me how to change gear and went that. And I drove out of the pit lane and all of a sudden, no turbo boost.
Ugh.
Oh, my God. And so I radioed in and said, there's no boost. Well, you've got to keep going. Just try and do as many laps as you can. Because it was only a half an hour to go and a lap takes 3.5 minutes or something. And so I'm buzzing along there down Mulsanne Strait in third gear with no power at all, flat as a biscuit, to these guys going past me. So anyway, to cut another long story short, we finished the practice like nothing. Then what had happened is that when they washed all the parts to put the new engine in, they washed it in solvent and the intercooler gasket had expanded and moved out. But anyway, we wouldn't have – and I didn't qualify because I didn't do enough laps. But we wouldn't have qualified anyway had I done my that extra lap, because our time was so much slower than the
it wasn't
class
fast
leader.
Enough to get in. Yeah.
But it was brilliant. You know, we had the pilots, well, pilots pass, so you had to pass with pilot.
Oh, pilot. Yeah. So, French for driver.
So Bondi and I and the girls and Brock were all in the Volkswagen driving around the inside of Le Mans. You know,
so you had the best pass for the race.
Exactly. And we had the driver sticker on the window of the BMW.
And they just wave you on in anywhere.
They waved us in everywhere. And we just went to go down this. We went and parked next to a golf course just on the side of the road, which the track went round it. Walked through some pine trees type of thing. And shit, here was the Armco.
You're on the track.
So we're sitting on the Armco at the end of Mulsanne Strait with cars doing like 300k, whatever they were. As they passed us, they put the brakes on and the turbos and the discs were glowing red, white hot. It was a bloody good trip, but of course it didn't mean anything.
it's a long way to go to not get to drive in the race, and what an amazing thrill just to drive around that place.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, that's another bucket list ticked of things. But Porsche for you, that you know, a little one off there, and then you go off in BMWs and Nissans, which we've talked about before, and I'm sure we'll talk about again. What started the – is it Peter Fitzgerald who we should blame for your Porsche thing? Because you ended up with a million of them later on and won a bunch of stuff in Nations Cup and Carrera Cup and Targas and all sorts of stuff. Is him getting you to drive at the 12-hour in one of those 968 club sports, is that where the whole Porsche thing for you sort of refired?
I've got to thank Pete every day because he got me the drive. Well, he chose the drivers and I co-drove with him in the 968 Porsche.
The Falcon tyres on the green. And
Falcon, yep.
Yep. And the Easter 12-hour.
In the 12-hour. Was it a 12-hour or 6? No, 12-hour.
12, yeah.
Yep. And I couldn't believe it. They'd run the year before. I said, "What have you done to the little cars to prep them?" He says,
"Washed them.
Nothing. We've washed them and cleaned them and tested them." And I said, "What about the engine? You know, like, no, it's only done.
Don't look at it.
10,000 k or something, whatever it is. Don't need to. You know, these motors will last for 100,000 k." I said, "You're joking." He said, "No." Anyway, we drove it around for the whole 12 hours. I didn't miss a beat. We had two of them in the team, and they were just brilliant cars. Brilliant cars. And so that started me thinking, geez, you know, these Porsches. I've never driven a Porsche until then. And the cars after the 12-hour race, and they did Targa Tassie as well, which I drove one of them. And the Porsche decided they would sell those two cars off because they owned them. And so they offered one to Pete, one to me, and one to someone else. I don't know who it was. And so I said, "Yeah, no, I'll buy one, and I can run in Carrera Cup, and I can run GTP, GT production."
Because that was just getting started, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the first time.
I think they called it Super Production to begin with, and then it became GTP, and Ross Palmer was backing it.
So I ran some of the GTP races, and Steve, my son, he ran in the Porsche Cup in the same car. So we'd come in and he'd just jump in and change
swap over.
Whatever.
Yeah, well, you don't have to change the name on the window. No, just exactly. Richards. It's exactly. Still Richards.
Exactly.
Off you go.
And so we had an absolute ball in that car, and then eventually sold it. And then when the first new Porsche that I bought was the 911 Club Sport.
RSC. They're worth a lot of money now, aren't they? Because there's not many of them around.
900,000, yeah.
Is that what it's worth now?
Yeah, well, the last I looked, I was 690 or something.
Don't look again.
No.
Don't look again.
But,
They were
Two nice like Porsche seats, grouse seats, no floor mats, no hood lining, no nothing apart from what you needed to actually. Did they have a roll cage in them?
They might have.
I think they might have.
I think Porsche always have an eye on racing.
Back part of a roll cage,
right?
Because you can't register them with the front part.
But
anyway, yes, that started my Porsche career. Career.
I was going to say it's career and era put together. Yeah, exactly. Carrera. It makes sense
exactly.
to me.
Yeah, so loved them. Had a great, satisfying times in the Porsches.
So how many Porsches have you had between GTP, Nations Cup, Carrera Cup, Targa, and Tarmac cars?
And I bought the first Porsche, let's say in 1993, and I've had 26.
Jeepers.
But none of them just as well. Maybe two of them as road cars.
They've always been competition.
They've all been competition, but all apart from the cup cars, They've been rally cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't really drive them on the road that much.
Mm. Mm.
But out of all those cars, like they never not missed a beat. Incredible.
Just amazing. Like you said, when you asked Fitzy about the engines in them and what, you don't touch them, you don't look at them, exactly. They're just like clockwork. It's incredible things. And the one that I recently talked to Carl Batson, who many in the industry will know, Bats is a long-time Porsche man. He worked with you on a lot of your Porsche race cars.
All of them.
yeah, couldn't get away from him. I asked him about a car I was doing some homework on, and that was so when GTP grew and it got so big that they kind of splintered it, so Nations Cup started with the Porsches and the Ferraris and the Lambos and the Vipers, and we'll talk about that. It's awesome.
Yep.
And the smaller cars like the Subarus and the Lancer Evos, and they sort of had their own thing, and then it just kept growing, so they had to keep splitting it out. So by the time Nations Cup was really humming along, you won the first couple in a club sport, the yellow GT3 club sport?
Yes. I'm pretty sure that's the case. Yep, yeah. I think we won three in a row.
Two in the club sport and then one in the cup car.
Yes.
So in 2002, this is before Carrera Cup was in Australia. It was a year away from coming. So by this stage, Stokel's Lamborghini, which was amazingly cool car, the Viper, I think Jeff Morgan had got his with Barry Jones up and flying.
Yep.
John Bauer was always lurking because he's always somewhere in a race. Yeah. He's in Ferraris with the prancing horse bikes. And you had a new 2002 cup car.
Yeah.
I reckon, and Bats agrees, and between us we kind of said this, and I'm interested in your take, of all the championships you've won in all the different cars and categories, I reckon that's the most unlikely championship win that you had.
Yes. Well, the three of them was just the last one.
That last one.
The last one 02. Was because the opposition were current top cars. And we didn't win many races, but we'd always finished on the top three type of thing. But I think that year there was only two of the 2002 Cup cars bought out, one for me and one for Fissy.
I think there was a couple, but you were the only two that were laying a glove on anyone at the front. I think so. Yeah.
Because when 2003 came along.
Then it was Carrera Cup and there was truckloads of them.
And that car, we upgraded it.
That's right.
To 2003 specs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But not for me to drive.
Not for you. I sold it, and you got a new one. But because that category was so parity based. Oh, the Lambo needs revs taken off it. Oh, Jimmy doesn't need any help. Oh, it was constant. People thought Group C was bad. Jeez,
the more you rang the organisers, the more things you got.
I reckon the Telstra bills in and out of Procar's office in Queensland and Cam's in Melbourne would have been something huge. But I think you'd won one race maybe all year. You just kept in the game.
Yeah, yeah.
And then last round on the Gold Coast, you blitzed them, you won all the races, and you won the championship in the last round.
Yeah.
But that was Porsche at its finest.
Yes.
Just trucking on. If you weren't winning, you were second or third or fourth.
Yeah, exactly.
You never failed to finish, whereas the other blokes every now and then would fall over. I reckon it's the most – if you went into that at the start of that championship, there's no way you would have thought you would have won that one.
Exactly.
It was incredible. Yeah. It's incredible. Just phenomenal. Phenomenal. So another topic that our followers are into big time, they love Touring Car Masters, love TCM, love the old cars, love all that stuff. Falcon and the Javelin are your two. Yeah. How did the Falcon come to be? Where did that come from? Why did you go that path? How did that one all come together?
Right, when I sort of stopped driving cars in the main game, I wanted just to build a car that could have some fun, just to drive for fun in a class that there wasn't a lot of preparation needed, and you could build your car and race it for a year without spending your money on it type of thing. So I looked around at cars, and I always had a soft spot for Falcon Sprints because Frank Gardner won the British Championship.
He did,
in the Falcon Sprint. And and at the time, there was a limit on rim widths, so there was only allowed 6-inch wheels on the Sprint, where you could have 7 and 8, I think, on the Mustangs and stuff. But I thought it's not the right thing to try and build up an older car and go into a class and try and dominate when you've had a successful career and you're probably one of the best drivers around.
Mm.
So I chose the Falcon because it had small tyres. I chose it because it had a 289 engine, which wouldn't give me as much puff. And so I just have some fun in, just to, midfield, front of the field if I could, whatever. So we got the car. Someone else was building one for Group N, or the Bugatti series, which it was. But the regulations were quite tight. Well, as I've started to find the car and build the car, the regulations changed. So then everyone was allowed to have 8-inch wheels, for instance. So that all of a sudden, well, that's good. It made my car
that's
a bit
free
better.
Kick. Yeah,
you know. And the fact that it was it was built with the fiberglass doors, bonnet, boot, it would run a lot lighter. So I thought that would be good. So we just kept building it, and as we were building it, things changed. You know, if it started off, you're allowed steel heads on the car, so we built it with the steel heads. Then as soon as we got it going, they said, oh, no, you can put belly heads on it now. So all of a sudden, we got to the stage where the car was fairly well sorted. It took about a year or so to get it organised. It took 2 years to build. And then we turned out like a car that we probably never thought we were going to build, even though we knew we were going to build a Falcon Sprint. To what mechanical specifications we really didn't know until it was finished building.
Mm.
So the first meeting we went to, it was pretty well. We got the car going. We took it to Calder, did 5 laps, didn't miss fire, didn't leak any oil, didn't overheat, put in the truck and drove to Darwin. and we qualified first or second and won a couple of the races.
It's funny how as you say, the plan of what it started to be
exactly.
versus what it became,
yeah.
or it sort of just became without you trying because of the way that the rules changed. There's you, John Bow, Medici, so a few of the guys who'd raced together over the years, and then a bunch of, I guess you'd say, you know, passionate enthusiasts who suddenly get to race with you guys who never would have dreamt of it. Cool cars.
Yeah.
Fans love them. They make the right noise. They slide. They do all that sort of stuff. TCM grew out of Group N to try to make things
more reliable.
And, you know, it doesn't have to be exactly correct because you don't want to have to spend stupid money to keep it all going. Where that car sits in all of the cars you've had, I guess it was pretty straightforward because, you know, by this stage you're running your own show, you do your own thing, you've got your own crew of guys, and it's nice and easy and you're going to do this for fun.
No, exactly. Well, I think I started racing my first races around 1964, and I finished my career.
Yeah, so you're 40-odd years
small
on. And
forward, back to where I was.
Yeah, I was going to say, someone's drawn the circle back 64, around.
1964 Anglia, and then the end of the deal, I was at a 64 Falcon Sprint. But they were genuinely, they still are, they're genuinely great cars to drive, terrific fun. I mean, they look like old cars, nice old cars. But they're fairly not sophisticated at all. They've got, you know, in the regs that I build mine to, they've got the standard suspension arms, everything, but you're allowed to modify them slightly within a certain period of space. But like at Bathurst, like they do 290K down Conrod because you've got no aerodynamics on them at all, and you've got to back off over the hump.
It's like the old
my car because it had no front spoiler, no rear spoiler.
Mm.
And but it was amazing, and they let me put a front spoiler and a rear spoiler on it because everyone else had one, and mine was the only car that didn't. So I put a little tiny one on just to try not to make it look non-genuine, but it didn't have to.
Yeah.
But and that fixed the lifting on the back straight.
I think the fans love clearly they love the drivers of that category, but the cars have kind of got their own followers, you know, people can connect to, you know, Camaros or the hardtop, the Mustangs, or then they brought the hardtop Falcons and the Taranas in to modernize it up a little bit. But there's, you know, Falcon fans from back in the day who've now got something old, new again to follow.
Exactly.
It sort of was the heart of why that category
successful. Dead right. But I sort of built the Falcon because it would be the last car that I'd probably drive, you know, have some fun. But of course, I was thinking that it would stay at the spec, and it was always going to say at the spec that we first built them at, everyone.
Mm.
Then, of course, every year that went by, they modified it, so you kept having to spending money. All of a sudden, it was costing a heap more than you ever thought it would.
I was here for fun from a high-speed game of golf, and suddenly we're playing full-on tournaments.
Exactly,
So was that what prompted the Javelin next door?
We had Bruce Tyson. And Mick Webb, Webby did all the engine and everything, and Bruce Tyson actually physically built the car with my input, and I helped, obviously, but Bruce did the spanner work, you might say, with modifying this and changing that. But we had so much fun doing it and racing it that we thought, well, why don't we build another car with a 6-litre engine, and really all the things on the Falcon that we maybe didn't quite get spot on, we'll get. And what sort of car do we need to go for? And I was a Roger Penske fan in the old days with Mark
Donohue.
Mark Donohue, yep. Driving, and he won the Trans Am Championships in 71, I think, in a Javelin.
Mm.
So I said to the boys, what about a Javelin? What? So a Javelin, they're sort of a funny-looking car, but they've got the right size engine. No one else has got one. And I reckon it'd be neat. And so anyway, we decided, yeah, well, okay, away we go.
So where do you find an AMC Javelin to start with?
Oh, they're everywhere.
Are they? Is it a thing?
They built 180 of them in Australia.
Physically?
Right-hand drive.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. But apart from that, you know, they import them. They're like old muscle cars. But, yeah, because there's something different, but very, very similar suspension to a Falcon. We'll have a few little things that, you know, were slightly different. But basically, we wanted something that no one else had, only because we've been building it for the class as well as the fact that we wanted to build a car. In hindsight, we probably would have been better building a Mustang or a Camaro, but there's already half a dozen of each.
Piles of them, yeah.
So we didn't really want to go that way. But, we refined little bits and pieces that we could on the Javelin that we hadn't done on the Falcon, and it became a slightly better car, yeah. But, of course, as we were doing that, everyone else was rebuilding and everything. So the poor old Jav had two massive crashes, and the last time I rebuilt it, I said, that'll do.
Not going to do it again. Because it was one of them at Sandown, I think, coming out of the main straight.
First one was Sandown. It was a back-of-the-grid start for the front.
Reverse grid.
And, all the cars were in front. The fast ones are trying to get through the slow ones. And, no one nowadays, and even then, just takes it a bit easy. And anyway, I come around the corner, and the two cars in front of us, and all of a sudden, and I was behind them, just going to sort of make a move, coming out of the corner, and all of a sudden, they just parted. I thought, what the fuck? Jesus. Woof.
Straight in.
Yeah. Bent the chassis, moved the floor, everything. But amazingly enough, not much more in the car, apart from the body, was damaged. So we had to go and find another Javelin shell, but we had to bought a car, and
was it in Australia?
Craig Moreland is on the Javelin Car Club, so we kept in touch with them, and they supplied us some parts and stuff, which we pay for. But Craig was brilliant, and he had a factory bigger than this, full of Javelins, old ones, wrecked ones, you name it. So we went down, and there's about three or four to choose from, and we chose the white one. And then we stripped that out, and what we did, we took the broken and bent chassis to Marty Brandt at International Race Cars, and then we took the new body shell, bead blasted, and everything, and painted an undercoat, and gave it to Marty beside the other one, and he replicated, because he did most of the chassis work anyway, he replicated the bolt holes, the plates, the this or that, so that when we took that new body shell back to the workshop in the factory here behind you, everything that was off the beaten up shell went straight on, diff went straight in, gearbox, motor, everything. And so it worked out really good. And then a year later at Adelaide, first race of the season, just a normal grid race. No, it was a reverse top 10.
No, oh, the reverse again.
And, one of the Mustang off Terry Lawler, actually, it was one of his first drives, had a lose at the chicane, and I was out in the open, just beautiful. Next minute I came out of right field, this car going backwards, whoomp, right in the side of the Jav, and just bent every single panel on the side, bent the chassis.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the car finally came to rest, it was against the tires on the other side of the track, so I pushed the other side in as well.
Finished it off.
So we sent the body again to the boys up in Tenterfield, and they repaired it for us, and it came back better than new.
Mm. But let's not do it for the third time.
So I said, no, we won't run that anymore. And we ran the Falcon, which was sort of retired. We ran the Falcon in the last season.
Yeah. Let's not go rebuilding anymore. You'll run the nation out of them.
Time you went out in the later years from when I was in TCM, you were battling against guys running into you. You spent more time looking in the mirror and looking around where you were than actually
racing.
Looking out the window of the racetrack.
Which was the aim of the game, was to have a bit of fun.
Exactly.
You mentioned about Penske before. You got to drive one of the amazing Penske Donoghue cars, the Can-Am.
Yeah.
Was it Porsche 91730?
Yeah.
It was at Albert Park, wasn't it?
I drove it for a couple of laps at Phillip Island. Just demo laps.
Amazing car. Oh, yeah. Like 1,000 odd horsepower in its day. Insane.
And then, as you say, Grand Prix track. But beautiful. I mean, I got to feel the power that it had, but not down the straight, because it was fairly dodgy down the straight for over the years. But massive acceleration, massive.
Insane. And you've ended up being, you know, even just the things we've talked about with sitting in Dan Gurney's office, driving one of these cars that Mark Donoghue drove, you know, Penske
exactly.
guys.
Yeah.
You know, it's been an amazing way to, from – you know, punting around in imps and stuff in New Zealand to doing all this cool stuff.
That's just the start of it.
Yeah. We've barely touched the surface on this.
We've got to the end before we've got to the middle.
Yeah. There's a whole pile of other stuff to roll through. Speaking of rolling through, I've got a few questions which our listeners have put in through our socials.
Yep.
We call it the couch racer questions because, you know, fans are on the couch and they're couch racers.
That's me too now.
Yeah, that's right. You're a very highly qualified one. And it's brought to us by the National Motor Racing Museum up at Bathurst, who, by the way, are open 6 days a week. Don't go on Tuesdays. They're closed. So you can't get in the door. You can't push your way in. But if you want to know the opening times, go to the museum's Bathurst website. Frank's got the first question, and he wants to know about your time driving super trucks. I know you've driven everything, but – I forgot that you did that. Trucks, why, how, where? What was the story
Well,
there?
I they had a truck race. It might have been one of the first ones at Calder. And they had the Truckies Mates race, they called it. And so I had a deal with Mobil, and Paul Freestone, who I hadn't met at that stage, his truck was sponsored by Mobil. So he was looking for a Truckies Mate guy to drive the
which
truck
was
mate race.
Their way of a co-driver,
more or less,
in separate races.
And so I decided, no problem, I'll have it run. So I had a drive, and it was, I mean, initially they were, Paul's truck was like it was a winning truck, but you know, good power, not that good with brakes, tires like big knobbly tires on them and everything, and it was terrific. But it was all the cars truck the same as they modified the trucks over the years. They become proper little race trucks, you know.
And was that one of the big beefy ones, not the little lightweight trucks?
No,
like that was a big Kenworth or something like that?
Kenworth, yeah. And then later I drove a truck for Scania, a cab over style of truck, where Paul Freestone's was a long nose.
Mm.
And I had a lot of fun, a lot of fun.
Just different. Well, but box ticked, you did
it.
It was a thing. Jared Minogue wants to ask about the Volvo S40, the super touring car. And the Bathurst win you had with Rickard Rydell, the world's fastest florist, Rickard. Do you rate that one as highly as the others? Because I feel like that's the forgotten one versus the Brock ones and the Scafey ones and the Nissan ones. The Volvo one, because the 2-litre V8 thing was going at the time, it's a bit unfairly sort of forgotten a little bit.
Yeah, I think it is. But the thing is that Australian race fans went into more of the V8s and all the current named drivers, and we had overseas drivers, and some names they wouldn't have recognised. But the Volvo itself was an absolutely brilliant car to drive, and I treat that as just as good as any of the others, mainly because from purely a driving point of view, the car was an absolute weapon. It was just beautiful. And, like, you drove it flat out for 6.5 hours or 7 hours, wherever it was, didn't miss a beat. But it was a great car to drive.
Mm.
You'd hardly know it was a front-wheel drive car.
Yeah. Five cylinders, just the sound, just unique.
But that was when the hullabaloo was – was a Channel 7, Channel 10.
Yeah, all that
something,
was going
something,
on.
Something, something, something.
Yep.
That Bathurst was the date.
Traditional
of
date.
The traditional Bathurst, but of course not with the traditional cars.
Yeah. I think the good thing is over history, we count both the races because they were Bathurst 1000s with elements of what we all knew.
Yep.
And I think you and Steve were the only ones to drive in both each year all the way through. Yeah. So you never missed one, whether it was two liter or the V8, yeah, you guys yeah. were able to, and you know, you finished second together in the V8 race, yeah, then you were yeah. first and second in the 2 liter. So you didn't just go in them. You went pretty well. I've just thought of a question. Remember that they wouldn't let Brock drive the red Volvo at Bathurst 1 year because they wanted him to do his HRT yes. thing. And that started you with the yeah. Volvo thing. Yeah. So you did that weekend. On the Sunday, it pelted with rain.
Yeah.
And you won that race in the 2 liter race, which wasn't championship. It was a one-off thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And that sort of thing. I've heard a murmur or three. You might be able to confirm or deny. You might not know. But Volvo at the time might have been a bit iffy to stay in Super Touring.
Yeah.
How could Brad Jones in a four-wheel drive yeah. Audi in a race like that not give you a run for your money?
Yeah, well,
do you reckon that they might have gone easy on you in that one
to let Volvo win?
No, I've heard that story.
No,
I don't know if it's true.
You wouldn't reckon? No.
Brad Jones wouldn't give a win away.
But he was stuck down the grid a bit.
And he
didn't have a good start. When he down the grid, I think he might have been. I think I was in the front row. I think with the BMW,
like Beardo and Brabham and Morris yeah. and those blokes were all.
And maybe, and I don't know why, but we had a Michelin tyres on our car. Now we're not sure whether the Audis had the Michelins or not.
I think there were still Dunlops in that time.
Yeah, I think
they swapped later in.
And at the time, the Michelin were probably the best tyre to have.
Mm.
And I found it dry. Like I hadn't driven it in the wet until the race, I think, because the practice was dry.
Yeah.
I think Beardo and I battled for the lead in the other race. But, I managed to pass one of the BMWs, you know, after one or two laps. And then just started to pull away, but then Brad in the Audi was catching me towards the end of the thing. But I mean, all I had to do was keep an eye in the mirror, and I always remind him of that—the fact that
I'm due to chat to him soon, so I'll get his side of that too as well. Stephen Brennan's got a question: would you let Steve or your grandson, which is Clay, Steve's son, anywhere near the TCM cars? Would they ever be allowed to have a little drive of those, or are they parked up? No one's having.
Well, they're parked up and no one's having a go. And the longer you leave them parked up, the more work you've got to do on them to
so make sure things. They need a little bit of a run.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah. I start them up probably every month.
Yep.
And it takes me a day to start all the race cars up.
there's a few in here, just quite. There's a few.
But no, probably not, because they're aiming for bigger and better things.
Mm.
And as you know, every time you drive a car out the door onto a track, you run the risk of damaging something or blowing something up or whatever.
True.
So, yes, they're probably not, but they can watch the videos.
There's a bit of that around. Ray Weeks got a question. Ray's a lovely fellow. For those who don't know Ray, for many years he was the lovely face and voice that met you when you went to the Gold Coast Indy Race, and he ran the media centre for the event organisers. Still see Ray when we go to the Gold Coast.
Oh, good stuff.
Not that we've been there for the last few years racing, but he's asked me this a few times, and he sent me a photo as well. So in 92, of course, it's famously known what happened on the podium and all that. Mm. But the day before, there was a driver's parade in town. He drove the car that you and Scafie in that day.
Oh, incredible.
And I think it was his car from memory too. And I didn't know this, but he said, you guys got soaked. I don't know if there were people threw fired water pistols at you. Or I don't think people know that part of, you know, they know the bit on Sunday. So what happened on Saturday? Did you get attacked in the driver's parade by punters or something?
Yeah, but they had those big – you know, this big squirt of bulky things. They get pump action things.
Oh, pump action water pistols?
Yeah, monsters.
And they just rip on you too.
We were ducking for cover and having a laugh. And there was other guys. The other guys were getting a bit of a drenching as well. But we probably got the most drenching because we were in a Nissan.
So that had no part to play what happened the next day?
No part to play, no. They had been squirting on the road, and I could have got some practice.
So next time for any podiums that you might think might be a little bit frosty for young racing drivers, take a water pistol. That'll disarm everything.
Yeah, especially if it's a tour. I don't know if it's a parade down the field.
Yeah. Get a few people back. Steve Hallam, I think we did cover this last time we saw you, but we've been asked by a few people, what race cars have you kept and what would you have liked to have kept? It's a long list of still what you've got.
Yeah, exactly. I kept the one of the M3s that we ran the 87 Touring Car Championship, which I drove in the first two or three rounds of the
Because there were a few different ones of those.
Yeah, I ran two cars in the Touring Car Championship, and they had a brand new car at Bathurst. So they rotated them around a little bit. But the one that I've got is the first one that was built. And I've got the HR31 Skyline that we won in 1990.
Yep.
I've got the Falcon, obviously, the Javelin. That's the only race cars I've got. But as for I wish I'd kept all of them.
Yeah.
But I suppose the Falcon would be the other one, this Falcon Sports Sedan, I wish I had kept. But it's changed so much now from where it was, different body panels on it and that to make it try and go faster.
Yeah.
I would like to, only because of the technical knowledge that was put into it through Murray. It was like the Corvair. It was way ahead of its time, but it didn't have, you could say, that successful a career, mainly because it just didn't have any money to spend.
Mm. And wasn't there a time when you did own the 635 JPS car? Well, you don't have it now, but you had your championship-winning car there for a time.
Yes, I did.
After it finished racing.
Yep, I did, and that was it had a broken crankshaft, and it sat in the corner of Somerivas.
Joe Somerivas. Yeah, privateer driver. He had it. Yeah. I think Gary Rogers had had it.
Gary had it.
Before
Gary sold it to Joe, and Joe took it to New Zealand and broke the engine, and then brought it back and put it in the corner of his workshop. And so I can't remember how much I bought it for. I think it was might have been $18,000 or something. Anyway, when I went to pick it up, it was grey. Cement dust and gravel dust and stuff all over it, an inch thick. And so I did tape, and then I was going to restore it, and I thought, oh, it's too much for me.
Too hard.
Yeah, so I consulted a really nice guy, John Hebron in Canberra. He was a BMW fanatic, and he cleaned it up, fixed it up, and he ran it in the races every now and again.
And it's in its JPS 62 colours, livery.
And now I've got Adrian Brady runs it.
Yeah, yeah, beautiful
and,
car.
Yeah. I would have liked that. Was one car I would have liked to have kept, obviously, because it had six race wins in a row or something, and won the Endurance Series, Sandown 500, the Touring Car Championship, AMSCAR Series.
Mm. Mm.
So it had a great history.
Yeah, did it all. Tim Matheson, I like this. This is not bad. Do you still have the stylish brown leather Tui's Top Gun jacket from the Bathurst wins in the Nissan days?
Yes,
remember those jackets?
Yes, I do.
You do? You still got it? Is it faded? Does it still look?
No, it looks all right. I've never worn it.
Oh, you've got to get it out again. You've got to get it out.
Yeah.
Oh, good to know. Yeah. A bit of Bathurst history that's still around and hasn't gone anywhere. Nigel Fall, who was the competitor that brought out the best in you? That's a good question. I like that.
The guy that was in front of me. Because you had to try and pass him or beat him. But I've had like Peter Fitzgerald, for instance, in the GT production series, and the one before that in the Starions and the RX-7s.
Oh yeah.
Like he was always the benchmark to actually get to and beat, because he was always competed at the front. And so Fitzy and I had some brilliant races, really really good. And he was in his Porsches, he was as good as I was virtually, but I left my cars as they were. Pete would tinker, and sometimes that would let him down. But he was good. But you know, I mean, all the drivers I drove against, you know, even guys who were behind us, you respected them, because I mean, the only reason they might have been behind you was because they didn't have quite a good enough car.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, when you're racing at the front of any series, you know, like the Super Tourers, the Nations Cup, the Porsche Cup, whatever. There's always different people put their hands up to say, well, hey, you know, beat me.
Mm.
You know, and if they're leading, you got to try and beat them. So that's probably the best analogy I can give you.
Yeah. If you're in front in any category, you're going, all right, yeah,
exactly.
You're the person exactly. to beat. We have a partnership with the motorsporttrader.com. They deal in memorabilia, car racing parts, all sorts of bits from over the years. They're keeping Aussie motorsport memories alive. So, for our listeners, have a look at their website, is what I was trying to say, which prompts the question. They've got all sorts of stuff, panels and guards and all sorts of stuff from race cars over the years. memorabilia, man. I know some drivers who've kept every race suit and every trophy and every helmet and every. Have you kept a few things along the journey that are crucial things that you?
I've sold a few helmets, and I've sold some overalls to a guy that I know in Perth who's just a mad collector, a really nice guy, and but I've still got one of the Holden dealer team suits that I wore and won in 1979-80, I think.
Oh yeah, cool. Very cool.
Or 78-79. I've got to go back on the video and
line up the logos.
I've got the BMW suit, and what have I got? The Commodore suit. I've got about 20 suits left.
Right. Oh, well, yeah, okay.
But yeah.
We won't call you a full-on hoarder, a total throw-out king either.
No. Like the trophies, they're just sat there because there was nowhere else to put them and really didn't want to throw them away for that reason, you know.
Yeah. Do you reckon back in the day they did a better trophy? Like in the 70s and 80s there were some pretty trophies I reckon they lost their way in trophy design. I reckon they need to.
I reckon because sometimes they make them look spectacular and all that sort of stuff, but they're made of plastic.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a real trophy. They're a lot better to keep. I've had mine 20, 30 years, never cleaned them.
Yeah.
They're still shiny.
You got a few. We are in your workshop. There's a few floating around. Any that stand, I mean, looking at, there's some cool designs from back in the day, but is there any, I mean, obviously you cleaned up when you won that Sports and End series with the stuff you got from Janie, but beyond trophies, is there anything else cool that you've won over the years that is a bit interesting or different to the norm?
Not really.
Trophies are pretty there was a bit of a period there where they gave clock trophies.
I've got a few different types of trophies like that. And I suppose I keep the Bathurst ones and the Touring Car Championship ones that I've got. At home, so a bit special, but all the run-of-the-mill trophies, you just took me out of their boxes and put them in the workshop.
Well, it's a very big run-of-the-mill. There's plenty of them floating around. Yeah, you would probably need a full-time cleaner. There are that many trophies.
Yeah, my wife said if I cleaned two a day, I'd have it done in a year.
I reckon you're underestimating there. I reckon there's probably 2 years worth of work. Just quietly. Jimmy, thanks for your time. Great to catch up. And you know what? We have not covered at all. There's still plenty of stuff to cover. And just quickly too, before we go, last time we chatted in 2019, I get my years mixed up these days, we had a question from a fan who asked about, would you do a book? Have you changed your thoughts? Would you do a book? Are you open to the thought?
I'm open to the thought, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right. I always worry about a book, though, that I might forget something that was quite important to someone else.
When it's your book, though, you do what you like.
No, exactly. But you'd like to sort of get it done properly.
All right. So it's not a no and you'd like it done properly.
Do you know anyone that might be able to do one?
I've got an idea. I know a bloke. I know a few. Let me have some talks and we'll see what we can come up with. Last time it was a no. This time it's a maybe. Hopefully we do another chat in 2 years' time or sometime soon and we might get a yes out.
No, exactly. You never know.
A big thank you to Jim Richards. It was fabulous again to catch up with him and sit down in his workshop surrounded by a bunch of his really cool race cars, trophies on the walls. I reckon if you'd told me as a kid that I'd be sitting in Jim Richards' workshop shooting the breeze with him about his amazing career, I'd have thought you were crazy. But that is exactly what we did again. Special thanks to JR for spending the time with us. Christmas is coming, sleuthers. Bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Link is in the show notes. Got a bunch of cool books and stuff that you need to be across for Christmas, including stuff for the older race fan, the younger race fan, DVDs with classic Bathursts, prints, all sorts of collectibles. Jump on the website, including a few model cars too. We don't stock heaps of model cars, but we do have a cool range, including the 2020 Scott McLaughlin Championship winning Mustang that's just arrived online. So grab yourself one of those. If it's not in the online shop yet, it will be very, very soon. So keep an eye. We've got a pretty limited run of those. Podcasts. I've got to recommend a few before I go. The Castrol Motorsport News podcast with Andrew Van Leeuwen and Stefan Bartholomaeus. The boys are on fire. They're great analysis and deep dive of contemporary motorsport. They've got so much to talk about. Don't miss an episode. It's a real cracker. New podcast that debuted in the last few months. It's going to surge on and grow in 2022. Repco Supercars Weekly is back every Thursday on the run-up to Christmas, just to tie up all the loose ends from another big year in the Repco Supercars Championship as well. All right, that's us done. The V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. I'm Aaron Noonan. I will chat to you with our next episode next week.